One man in particular is looking forward to coming home aboard Atlantis. Astronaut Dan Tani has been in orbit for 4 months. We're going to hear more from him in a few minutes. He's written and recorded an essay from the space station for our This I Believe segment. But first, a story about working satellites and how photographs from space are giving scientists more information about Earth. A new book, Our Changing Planet, The View from Space, published by Cambridge University Press, uses satellite imagery to show how much our planet has changed over the past few decades and the effect humans are having on the Earth. Earlier this week, we drove out to NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, to talk to two of the scientists who edited the book.
Michael King, I'm a senior research scientist at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, where I've worked for about 30 years, and I'm chief scientist of the Earth Observing System, a system of 10 Earth-orbiting satellites.
Hi, I'm Claire Parkinson. I'm also at NASA Goddard Space Flight Center, and I'm also project scientist for one satellite, which is the Aqua satellite that's in orbit around the Earth.
I know you've created a book for us to be able to see some of the images that you work with every day. Who uses this information?
In this book, what we've tried to do is get scientists who are experts in their field to write just a few pages that will allow the general reader to understand what's going on. This book is written by experts so that you're getting the right information, but written for the general public.
Michael, you're going to show us, is it a graph we're going to see? Yes, tell us about this graph.
There's an interesting story behind nitrogen dioxide, which I think people find quite interesting. Nitrogen dioxide is a gas. It is observable from satellite. It's got three different primary sources: automobiles, lightning, and coal-fired power plants. Because it's a short-lived gas, it also shows the life cycle of man's use of transportation corridors. And so we look at the signature from this gas by day of the week. And in Europe, it drops on Sunday to nearly 50% of the value during the weekdays. This is a clear signature of the Christian holy days. In contrast, if you look at Israel, dominant Jewish religion, it shows a low on Saturday, which is the Jewish Sabbath. And finally, if you look at the Islamic cities of the Middle East, where Friday is the holy day of Islam and the day of rest, it also drops noticeably to about 80% of what it is during the week. You can basically see the dominant religious preferences of the world from satellite.
That's fascinating. Claire, let's turn to you and an image. It is labeled Destruction of the Aral Sea. What do we see here?
Well, the sea. Now the sea is partly Kazakhstan and partly Uzbekistan. So it was after the breakup of the Soviet Union that it became split into two countries. And what we see in these two images, one is from 1964 on the left and the other is from 2006 on the right, that's the same sea. And yet you look at it, it doesn't look like the same sea at all because of how much the sea has decayed. 80% of the volume of the water retreated. This is one of the greatest environmental disasters of the 20th century and one that was definitely produced by human beings. There are two main rivers that flow into the Aral Sea, and people upstream diverted the water for irrigation for cotton crops and for rice crops, meaning less water got to the Aral Sea, and yet the amount of evaporation from the Aral Sea stayed the same. And so you were losing water from evaporation. You were no longer getting the water added from the river inflow. And then all that area that had been sea, that's salt, dust, sand that's being blown all over the place. It's polluting the entire region. So it's got all sorts of environmental consequences.
To look at those two photographs, I mean, even though one is black and white from 64 and one is color, you really can see the difference.
And you can see how it was just devastatingly retreated. Wow. The sea started decaying in the 1940s and 1950s, but nobody knew it except for the people living right along it, and nobody was that much concerned. With satellites now, anything this much of an impact. It's going to be seen from satellites, and people are going to know about it and maybe can start correcting it before it gets to as bad a state as what's happened with the Aral Sea.
Michael, you're going to show us this map, and here we are so with another picture.
I'm going to show an image here, which is from the MODIS sensor, one of NASA's sensors on the Terra satellite. And so this is a true color image, and it shows the Nile River Delta that includes Alexandria over to the Red Sea. The vast green from the Aswan High Dam through Luxor and up to Cairo and then blossoming out in the Nile River Delta. All of the agriculture and fertile land is within 20 or 30 kilometers of the Nile River. And the eastern desert, which is what's called on the east side of the Nile, is just sand. I've driven hours across that from snorkeling on the Red Sea, and it's very, very desert, very desolate. So it's clearly indicating of man's activity and long use of this area for agriculture in the areas where one can support life near the water.
And the satellite images actually allow you to see things almost as they are happening.
Two remarkable things. One, how quickly you can see it, which really is only in the past few years that that's happened. It used to take years for us to analyze data. So, you know, 10 years later, we'd still be analyzing a bit of data and still trying to get the first research results out on it. But the other remarkable thing about what the satellites allow is they give you the global view, so that it's no longer a case of you just have data from one little area where somebody happens to be sitting taking some measurements. You now can get the entire global view, which allows us to see so much more and understand the connections so much better than we ever could before.
The book is called Our Changing Planet, The View from Space, and we've been joined at the Goddard Space Center by Michael King and Claire Parkinson, both of whom are editors of the book. Thanks for inviting us into your workspace and showing us the images.
Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for having us.
You'll hear more about the effect of climate change on the Nile in the coming months when Weekend Edition takes a trip to Egypt this spring with NPR's Climate Connection series. And you can see satellite pictures of the Aral Sea and learn more about its decay at our website, npr.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Andrea Seabrook. As President Bush continued his African tour today, he won praise from Tanzania's president for U.S. help in fighting HIV/AIDS and malaria. Among the U.S. projects in Africa are malaria vaccine studies conducted by the National Institutes of Health involving the Malinke people of Mali. Reporter Addie Goss recently visited an NIH-funded facility in the village of Bankmanom.
Bankmana wakes up to the sound of women pounding millet outside their mud huts. During the rainy season here, the rice fields are flooded, mosquitoes are born, and malaria is like the flu. Everybody gets it. Modibo Jabate is a griot, a kind of village journalist. In Bankmana, he says, there's a severe form of malaria that kills the children. The Malinke call it konon, which means bird.
L'enfant convulse, ouvre les yeux.
The child convulses. He opens his eyes wide and screeches. It's like a bird has seized him.
There's a small health clinic here, but it can take people days to gather the few dollars for prescriptions. So until recently, most parents brought their sick children to the village healer, who gives them traditional medicine. They'd pay him in kola nuts.
Les gens sont là à la merci de...
People were at the mercy of the mosquitoes. Many children never reached 10 years.
Then, about 15 years ago, a Malian doctor came to Bankmana to study which strains of malaria were making kids sick. His name is Ogobara Dumbo, or Ogo, and the griot Jabate remembers that from the start, Ogo saved lives.
Donc on vient dans la famille. Hey, madame,
He went to families and he asked, "Madame, what brings malaria?" There were some who said it was cold water, some who said it was the mangoes, and Ogo said, "No, it's mosquitoes. You have to protect yourself. Clean your yard. Sleep under a mosquito net. Don't let containers of water sit around."
A few years ago, the Malian Dr. Ogo got a grant from the U.S. National Institutes of Health to start testing a malaria vaccine in 300 children here. Over time, that grant helped build a medical research center in the middle of Bankmana. They built it side by side with the local clinic, which didn't even have water or electricity. Ogo says parents signed their kids up for the vaccine trials partly as a matter of village pride.
They think they have opportunity to participate in an international challenge of developing a vaccine to save the life of thousands and millions of kids. Really, the first volunteer I have had, they added, they say, if you get a vaccine, they will say Bankmana was the first village. That makes them very proud, I can tell you.
There would be two groups of children. One would get a shot containing the experimental malaria vaccine. The other would get a shot of the control, a flu vaccine that had already been shown to be safe. The experimental vaccine had been tested for safety in adults in Mali and in the United States with no significant problems. But the only children who would receive the vaccine were 36 kids in another village. This raises questions for ethicists like Lawrence Gostin at Georgetown Law School. He says, ideally, you don't want to give vulnerable people like the Malinke anything that hasn't first been proven safe in children in the developed world.
Questions of, is there an undue incentive? Do the parents really understand? Is there the same culture? All loom very large.
But the NIH-funded researchers say they're doing everything they can to avoid exploiting the villagers. Most parents in Bankmana are illiterate, so the researchers read them an explanation of what the vaccine is and what the risks are. And they take pains to make sure parents understand what they've been read. Gostin says the bottom line is a malaria vaccine could save countless lives. And as they test it, NIH is providing desperately poor Malians with health care they wouldn't otherwise have.
There are some ethicists that think that if you have a trial in a developing country, that you use exactly the same standards as you do in the United States. I don't believe that that's true, because I think that if you take that standard, you end up not doing any service to people that are suffering desperately.
The researchers treat any child enrolled in the study for any illness. Parents here say they've enrolled their children for just that reason, because they can't afford to go to the village clinic. Then, to make sure they're not coercing people, the researchers also provide some health services to villagers who are not participating in the vaccine trials. Like this little boy. His dad took him to the village clinic today, and the doctor wanted to do some blood tests for liver failure, but the clinic doesn't have anything even close to a lab. So the doctor called the NIH-funded researchers, and now the boy is at the research center, having blood drawn for tests. The researchers do this for free. Even the traditional healer, Nyangana Fode, says he's thrilled the researchers have taken his patients away.
Before they came, I never slept because everyone brought their sick babies to me. Now, when a child comes here with a fever, I send him to the researchers.
The healer says this while sitting in bed in his hut. Over his head is a mosquito net the doctors gave him. Another day ends in Bankmana. Men and women walk back from the fields, and their children gather at the research center, one of the few places in town with electricity, to watch TV. For NPR News, I'm Addie Goss.
A few weeks ago, we asked NPR correspondent Joe Palca if he'd like to contribute something science-y for our occasional series about food and cooking. Sure, he said. What about the physics and chemistry that make a souffle rise or fall? Sure, we said. So Joe Palca rose to the occasion to explain the science of beating eggs.
I like to cook, and I've beaten plenty of eggs in my day. But I figured if I'm going to do a serious radio piece about beating eggs, I'm going to get the help of a serious chef. So I turned to Jeffrey Boobin. He's the owner and head chef at Vidalia, a restaurant in Washington, D.C.
Okay, well, if we want to take a recipe like a meringue or a souffle, we're going to separate the yolks from the whites. We're going to separate the fat from the protein.
Fat and protein. Remember that. The yolk has fat and some protein, but the white is all protein, no fat.
When I was growing up in the kitchen, the chefs would say, no goldfish. And what they meant was when you separate the eggs, sometimes when you separate eggs, you get a little nip of the egg yolk in the whites, and that would fall into the bowl. And if you brought the chef a bowl of egg whites that had goldfish in it, or tried to, you know, use those, he would pretty much throw you out of the kitchen and tell you to start all over again.
So why is it so important to make sure there aren't any goldfish in the egg whites? Because remember, yolks have fat in them. When you beat egg whites, you're basically mixing air into them. The protein in the egg whites forms a kind of skin around the bubbles of air. If there's any fat present, the skin can't form and the air leaks away. Even a trace of fat is ruinous, so no goldfish if you want a souffle. Now, there are some tricks to getting just the right amount of air into your egg whites.
You want to make sure you have a very clean bowl. You want to make sure that your beating takes place over a nice even flow of beating to incorporate the air, and you don't want to overbeat them and have too thick a mixture that it won't fold into your souffle or to your batter or to your sponge.
So Jeff's ready to start. He's wearing a spotless white chef's jacket, checked pants, and those clogs that all chefs seem to favor. He's got a large, clean, stainless steel bowl. Some say copper bowls work better, but Jeff's not convinced. He's got a large whisk and a carton of fresh eggs. He picks one up, holds it over his work table, and tells me something surprising.
You always want to crack an egg on a flat surface. What that does is it gives you less shell shatter so that when you go to add it to a recipe, you won't get little shards of shell in your recipe. So it comes with a much cleaner crack, one crack on a flat surface.
So not on an edge?
Not on an edge.
Never knew that. Jeff cracks open an egg and lets the white spill into one bowl, then he plops the yolk into a different bowl. He repeats this with two more eggs. Now, I have a little editorial note here from my editor, Allison Richards. She says if you're not as expert as Jeff Boobin in separating eggs, you might want to put the white from each egg into a small bowl, inspect it for goldfish, and only then add it to your mixing bowl. Now back to our story. Jeff picks up his whisk and starts to work on the egg whites.
What I like to do is I like to do start in circle eights just to break up the egg whites. And then you want to go in a circular motion, turn your bowl at about a 15-degree angle, and just keep whipping it and try to get as much air in as quickly as possible. And I have a lot of people say, we were doing a party last month and we were whipping egg whites by hand, and they said, I can't believe people still whip egg whites by hand. I said, I didn't know there was any other way.
About 4 minutes later, at a steady 180 beats per minute, our egg whites have transformed.
And now you're getting something that's really creamy.
And what we're looking for now is nice, beautiful peaks. Some chefs that I learned from say there's a point where you have the meringue perfect is when you just lose the shine from the egg whites. And we're getting very, very close to that point. As you see, peaks are starting to come up, nice and beautiful. And there we have it.
Amazing. I mean, it's just so different in texture.
This is fragile still.
Very, very fragile. So you have to move very quickly with it and be very gentle.
Move quickly because the air can still leak out of the tiny protein pockets, and move gently because the protein skins are thin and collapse easily. Jeff uses his whisk to mix the egg yolks and then takes a rubber spatula and begins to gently add the stiff egg white mixture to the yolks.
Just barely fold until it's incorporated. Okay, and then we're going to place that into a baking dish.
And put the baking dish into a 350-degree oven for 6 minutes. In the oven, those air bubbles trapped in the egg whites expand, making the souffle rise. The heat also causes the protein to stiffen a bit, and along with the fat from the yolk, it forms a kind of scaffold that keeps the souffle from collapsing.
All right, so now we're going to check on our omelet souffle. Oh, isn't that beautiful?
The egg mixture has nearly doubled in volume. Now, I'd probably eat it as is, but Jeff's got bigger ideas. While the souffle was in the oven, he made a reduction of wine and shallots, stirred in some butter, and now he spoons that mixture over the souffle, topping it off with a few shavings of black truffle. A couple of glasses of red wine appear.
Bon appetit.
And you wonder why I love my job.
That's NPR science correspondent Joe Palca at Vidalia Restaurant in Washington, D.C. You can watch this lesson from Chef Jeffrey Bubin on how to make the perfect souffle and get the recipe at our website, npr.org.
Joy is more infectious than leprosy. That short line effectively describes the life of Muralidhar Devadas Amte, better known as Baba Amte. He was a follower of Gandhi, who dedicated his life to restoring dignity to lepers, the disabled, and the marginalized. He died February 9th at age 93 at his renowned colony in India called Anandwan.
Baba means father. He was like a father to each and every one of us.
This is Mr. Prabhu. He is a senior volunteer at Anandwan, and he was inspired to help Baba Amte after meeting him 28 years ago.
Baba Amte, the first memory, the first impression when I saw him, was he was a man who was following Gandhi in practical. There are many people who use Gandhiji's name, but they never try to follow Gandhiji's in practical, but Baba was doing it. And that is how he created a self-sufficient village like Anandwan.
Anandwan means forest of joy, and visitors say even the most outcast who live there work and play with a smile on their face. Amte came from a moneyed family, but a chance meeting with a homeless leper spurred him to establish Anandwan as a refuge. There he gave treatment to society's outcasts. He taught them to farm, weave, and build machinery. Baba Amte often said of his leprosy patients, "Let them lose their limbs, but not their dignity." His mission spread beyond Anandwan to other ashrams, hospitals, a university, and a school for blind children. Baba Amte was remembered with a state funeral last week and was buried on the grounds of Anandwan.
This afternoon, the Bush administration sent Congress legislation aimed at bringing down the overall cost of Medicare. But this is no routine Medicare bill. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, it represents the first move in what could become an election year brawl on Capitol Hill.
Today's story actually began back in 2003 in a little notice section of the Medicare prescription drug law. It was designed to force the president and Congress to take action if too much of Medicare spending was coming from general income tax revenues.
We call it the Medicare trigger.
That's Health and Human Services Secretary Mike Leavitt. The trigger requires the president to submit a bill to Congress to bring Medicare general tax spending back under 45% of the program's total. In a conference call with reporters, Leavitt acknowledged that the administration had some doubts about whether to comply with the mandate that it send up actual legislative language. Some White House advisors wondered whether that was constitutional. But in the end, Leavitt said, the desire to deal with the growing cost of Medicare won out.
The president feels it necessary and important that not only he, but future presidents respond to this. And anything that can prompt, motivate, coax the Congress into dealing with this now, while it's still solvable, is an important part of the law.
The bill the administration is proposing has three parts. One would give the HHS secretary authority to impose relatively non-controversial programs aimed at getting better value for less money, things like electronic medical records. The second is a long-standing administration proposal to cap certain damages in medical malpractice lawsuits. The final piece would impose higher premiums for the prescription drug benefit for beneficiaries with higher incomes. Texas Congressman Jeb Hensarling, chairman of the Conservative Republican Study Committee, says that will appeal to his wing of the party.
And the prescription drug benefit should have been geared towards those who needed it the most, those who did not have a benefit, those who were of low and moderate income.
Democrats, however, oppose the proposal. In fact, they opposed the budget trigger in the first place, and they were quick this afternoon to call the measure dead on arrival. Part of the reason, says Richard Kogan, an economist at the Liberal Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, is that the trigger just calls for moving money around. It doesn't actually do anything to lower overall Medicare spending.
It does nothing to address the fact that we have long-run budget problems, including because of the rapid growth of health care costs in society.
In fact, he says, the way the trigger law is written makes it easy to raise regressive taxes, like the Medicare payroll tax, to replace progressive sources of funding, like the income tax. Another thing the trigger does is make it easy to get this particular Medicare bill to the House and Senate floors. By law, the leaders of both houses must introduce the measure, and the relevant committees are required to act on it or a similar bill by specific dates this summer. And if the Democrats refuse to bring the bills to the floor, there are special provisions that make it fairly simple for the Republicans to force a debate. Hensarling says he and his conservative allies plan to do just that.
House conservatives would try to use every procedural tool that we have to ensure that the law as we understand it is followed in at least one plan that will comport with the original legislation is brought to the floor.
But in the end, it may be moderate Republicans who could pay the price for a messy Medicare debate just weeks before Election Day. Democrats need only vote no on the bill. Republicans, however, may end up torn between a desire for fiscal responsibility and one of the government's most popular programs. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
World maps can give us a good idea of how people have shaped the land by showing roads, canals, and cities, but the same maps often leave the ocean nearly blank. Now a group of scientists has created a new global map that leaves the land blank and highlights how human beings are shaping the ocean. NPR's John Nielsen has this report.
Scientists like Ben Halpern think a lot about the ways in which mankind has changed the oceans of the world, for instance, by polluting them or by catching too many fish. But Halpern also knows that for a lot of people, this is a problem that is out of sight and out of mind.
You fly across the ocean in a plane, and you're on the plane for 12, 15 hours, and all you see is ocean, and you're thinking, my goodness, this is huge. How can we possibly be having an impact on such a vast resource?
Halpern works at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis in Santa Barbara, California. In the journal Science, he and a team of ocean experts have just published a dramatic-looking attempt to focus attention on what people are doing to the oceans. Essentially, it's a colorful and complicated map that highlights everything from ocean dumping to warming waters linked to climate change. Pristine areas are shown in blue, yellow, and orange patches show parts of the ocean that are under stress.
And then some bright red hot spots, which are the most impacted areas on the planet. And that's where a combination of human activities from shipping and fishing and climate change and land-based pollution are all coming together in combination to make things really bad.
Halpern says the reddest of these red zones tend to be near big cities and crowded coastlines. These are the spots where fish are hard to find and underwater landscapes tend to be mangled. Divers know these places when they see them, he says.
Things just start to look kind of gray because they're dying or they get overgrown by weedy algae that are generally not wanted or not healthy for the ecosystems. It starts to look unhealthy, basically, especially if you have a sense of what it's supposed to look like, which is lots of species.
According to the map, the most disturbed ocean waters include Europe's North Sea, the South and East China Seas, the Persian Gulf, and the part of the Atlantic near the east coast of the United States. Big blue bands of healthy waters are found near the poles. Smaller zones of healthy waters are found almost everywhere.
Most countries have some of these little patches of very low impact that are probably not pristine, but are getting close to being in really good condition. And that gives us hope that we can try to focus on these areas to make sure they stay in good condition and also give us a sense of what the ocean probably should look like if we want to try to restore some other areas that aren't in as good a shape.
Halpern says his map is far from definitive. It was assembled with data provided by the United Nations, the U.S. government, and researchers who filled out internet questionnaires, but it left a lot of gaps. For instance, the team lacked key information on the amount of fish and other sea life killed and thrown away by fishing boats. To fill in some of those gaps, they used computer models to guess at what they'd find in some parts of the ocean. But fisheries biologists like Larry Crowder of Duke University in North Carolina say this map could change the way people see the oceans. He compares it to the famous photos of the Earth taken from space by Apollo astronauts in the late 1960s.
That put everybody on the same page. You know, we live on a little blue dot. What this global map does, even the bold attempt to put it together, says, you know what, the ocean isn't infinite, and we can take too much out and we can put too much in. We can damage this system on which we all depend.
The team that drew this map is now attempting to develop much more detailed regional maps that might be used to help predict emerging threats to places like the waters off the coast of California. John Nielsen, NPR News, Washington.